The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, from Origi to Villarreal, a big week for subs on Merseyside. But from France to Bruno Jorginho, bad week for the Pens. We look at what went down and who might in the Premier League. Check out Xhaka's cracker. There's some fancy football and who we think should win Manager of the Year and more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hey listener, how are you? It's Monday the 25th of April. Here at Totally we've got Daniel Story, Adrian Clark and Rory Smith with us today. Hello everybody.
Hello.
Morning. Hello. James.
Right, yeah. Big week for, well certainly Rory and Story. You're heading off to those midweek Champions League things, yeah?
Yeah, I'm doing the Wednesday, Thursday. I think Rory's doing Tuesday, Wednesday.
Nice.
Yeah, we don't officially recognise the Europa League at the New York Times.
Have you not? Have you not stumbled across it yet?
We've written about the Conference League, oh, and yeah? I would have done the final if Barcelona had made it.
Right.
But on Thursday night, I think I'm going to the Italian embassy.
Oh, are you going to that thing?
Yeah.
Very big inquiry as to why, you know, Italian football isn't anymore.
Yeah, my wife's really worried. Because she thinks I don't dress appropriately to attend any embassy, let alone right. the Italian embassy.
Right.
She keeps looking at me as if to say, you are not going to fit in.
Have you tried out outfits in front of her?
Not yet, but I believe that's on the menu this week.
All right. Well, speaking of the menu, the scran, as I believe it's called, I think should be amazing. Is that
oh, really?
The reason you're going along? Horncastle will also be attending, I think.
Oh, amazing.
Mm. All right. Well, the rest of us will be dining out on some absolutely top Europa and Europa Conference League matches, and one or two of which we might touch on in the course of today's show. Adrian, I know you're keen to get going. He is, listener. let's start with a Merseyside derby. Burnley had won prior to this, and City had done Watford, meaning that as these two teams, Liverpool and Everton, faced off, Liverpool were 4 points behind City at the top of the table, while Everton were, for the first time this season, in the bottom three. It couldn't have been more dramatic. Woof.
Yeah, it was all set up, wasn't it, for Everton. The pressure was on, and it looked like they might just do an Atletico Madrid and just go the old-fashioned way and spoil a football match and ruin a really good team. And for a while it looked on, but for me, the Toffees just forgot the one thing that really is important when you come up against teams that are much, much better than you, and that is something you do actually need to have some of the ball. And that, I think, was their letdown in the end, really. They just didn't have enough of the ball to relieve the pressure on their defenders. And in the end, it was inevitable, wasn't it, that Liverpool would break them down. Some remarkable stats in the match. Mm. Absolutely phenomenal. Eight of Everton's 11 starters made less than 10 successful passes. That's just amazing. And Alan, the glorious Alan, who actually is a pretty good player on his day. He can get about the pitch and be competitive against anyone. He made one successful
one
pass.
One completed pass?
One successful pass.
It was on kickoff as well, wasn't it?
It was a remarkable performance in terms of the numbers from Everton. A lot of people were going around saying, oh, it was a near perfect game plan. No, it's not. It's not a near perfect game plan. You've got to have a threat.
Was the issue that they didn't have enough of the ball or they didn't have enough of the Divock Origi?
Yeah, I mean, Origi is the game changer. I think Everton clearly got spooked when Liverpool made their changes, which they were always going to do. They always had Luis Diaz and Origi, the kind of man of Liverpool moments, particularly in this fixture, to come on. So it shouldn't have been any surprise that happened. But they did seem to be a little bit surprised by this kind of new movement. Diaz driving at them from the left rather than drifting in like Jota does. Origi just popping up in the penalty area where other players aren't, which is a lot harder than it sounds. I mean, it was partly by design that Everton didn't have the ball. And I did think they were a threat on the counter-attack. The counter-attacks they attempted were really exciting, but they were only ever done with one player at a time. So it was Anthony Gordon generally driving on, sometimes Alex Iwobi. And they just, it was kind of classic nosebleed territory. They got into the penalty area and then sort of looked surprised that they got there and didn't really know what to do and didn't have any support. And yeah, I agree eventually that that is going to come back to haunt you, because Liverpool, I don't think Jordan Pickford really made a save until Liverpool's goal, first goal. But when that happened, it's so hard to change gear and then get yourself back into the game.
Was it Joel Matip giving Anthony Gordon a nosebleed on one of the occasions? Did Everton have a case for a penalty at all on one of those tumbles?
Well, I missed minutes 45 to 60 as I was having my tea, and I came in. We've got children. You eat when they want to eat. And I didn't see the penalty incident until afterwards. And I'd sort of vaguely heard Martin Tyler talk about Everton had a strong claim for a penalty. And I didn't know if he meant maybe the one that Jordan got booked for diving in the first half. And then I saw the one that with Matip. And if I'm completely honest, I'm baffled that that's so controversial. That isn't really even a ghost of a penalty. The only point at which there's any contact, from what I can see, is when Jordan is already halfway to the floor. I can see why that maybe there was a bit of a cheer from the Everton fans and a sense of injustice from them, because it looked like, you know, one of those potential, oh, maybe that could be a penalty you've seen them given. But I don't think you do see that given, to be perfectly honest.
Rory, I agree with you. I don't think it was a penalty, in my opinion, because he steps across the defender and it's just a coming together. I don't think Matic could do anything about it, to be honest, because he's sprinting back towards his own goal. But if that is at the other end and it's Liverpool, I genuinely do believe it's given. I do. I just think the probability of that being given, if it's Liverpool in that match, is way above 50%. I would say 75% chance that gets given. So I understand the frustration from Everton's point of view, but in my opinion, I don't want penalties given for that.
All right. You had some amazing stats about Everton's first half. Let's have some numbers about Divock Origi. He averages a goal every 56.5 minutes against Everton in the Premier League. That's insane. Only Steven Gerrard has scored more Premier League goals for Liverpool against Everton. He's played significantly more against them. He also averages a goal or an assist every 62 minutes this season, Origi. To put that into context, Cristiano Ronaldo... Have I nicked this from you, Daniel? Is this from your...
No, I don't think so. You keep going.
This is somewhere else, right. So to put that in perspective, Cristiano Ronaldo averages a goal contribution every 118 minutes. So that's almost twice as good as Cristiano Ronaldo. Why on earth might he be leaving?
Well, there is a slight caveat in terms of sample size, in that before Sunday he'd only played 71 Premier League minutes.
Right.
But I think that's that doesn't take anything away from him. It's much harder than people think to, you know, people believe in this perception that, oh, well, he's going to come on and he's going to score against Everton, or he's going to make a difference against Everton, because he always does. That's a lot harder than you think when you've barely played any competitive minutes. His ability to just sprint from a standing start in terms of coming into what was a really fevered atmosphere, very raw from not playing much football, and immediately, with his first touch, he basically creates... I mean, it's a brilliant cross from Mo Salah, but he helps to create the first goal. And then gets in the right position for what was a fabulous assist for Luis Diaz. I feel a bit for Diaz, because the whole thing became about Origi scoring the header from 1 yard out. It was an amazing overhead kick assist. And Diaz, again, he's the reason, one of the reasons that Origi is leaving, because with Fabio Carvalho coming in, with Diaz there, with Jota not been there so long, they just don't need Origi anymore, and he wants more minutes. It sounds like Milan are interested, I think. That's been the rumours, which, you know, it's very hard for him now, because he has built this reputation as this sort of super sub, this kind of man of moments, and the pressure will be on him to kind of keep up that relentless, those stats you mentioned. He's not going to be able to do that when starting every week, but it's really interesting for him how he picks that next club, I think. I don't really think Milan's an obvious fit, but then it's a big club that he thinks he can start every week at. So, wow. All right.
Well, also potentially spending next season in a different league altogether are Everton, now 50 points below Liverpool. Are they going down?
Do you know what? I've not thought at any point this season that Everton would be relegated until I looked at the table yesterday and realised that Burnley are 2 points ahead of them rather than one. Because I got the maths wrong. And that means that by the time Everton play Chelsea on Sunday, if Burnley have beaten Watford, which is perfectly feasible because Watford are abysmal at home,
right,
then Everton are 5 points adrift.
Watford have lost every home game since November.
And Burnley, to be fair, have been brilliant since sacking Sean Dyche. So suddenly that looked maybe a month ago like it might be tense draw, neither team getting what they needed. But all of a sudden you look at that and think, well, Burnley are probably favourites to win that. Watford seem doomed. So Everton, who have got a vastly better squad than Burnley, who've spent £500 million, who should be kind of competing for the top half finish, say, could go into a game with, what, four left of the season? 5 points adrift of safety. Wow. That, I mean, that is it. This is as close as, was it 93 that they came within 25 minutes of going down and they pulled it off against Coventry or something, or Wimbledon?
A little bit later, I think, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, come really close once before in 93 or 94. But this is, I mean, this is an absolute emergency for them. And I heard on the commentary yesterday, there seems to be this consensus that Lampard knew he was taking a tough job. And obviously, the structural issues at the club are massive. The ownership has been terrible. The way it's been run is amateur. Benitez was a weird appointment. It split the fan base. It created a kind of toxic environment. And it was a tough job. But Lampard's made it look a lot harder than even that, to be perfectly honest. They weren't in the bottom three when Lampard took over, and that's where he's taken them. And I find it really weird that there seems to be this consensus of opinion that Lampard is doing the best he can. That's not how this works at all.
Is the Chelsea game home or away?
It's at Goodison Park.
Oh, well, that's something. Of course, what a match. What narrative there'll be swirling around that one. Frank Lampard with potentially his former club landing a decisive blow in Everton's survival hopes. Burnley, as you mentioned, taking 7 points from a possible nine since sacking Sean Dyche. Daniel making the point that almost exactly a quarter of all their points this season have come over the last 8 days. Were you expecting that, Daniel?
No, I wasn't. I really wasn't. This feels really churlish to say because they've done really well, but I don't think the owners particularly knew what they were doing when they were sacking Sean Dyche, other than removing Sean Dyche from that equation, I guess maybe because they thought he was going to leave at the end of the season and they thought they were going down with him. The fact that they went with, you know, interim coaches, internal appointments, suggests that they didn't have anyone lined up and that they didn't necessarily believe that those coaches were going to reinvent Burnley, but they kind of have. You know, I was looking at the stats from the weekend and, you know, three of the nine games this season where they've completed passes like at more than 70% in a game, which is unheard of for Burnley normally, have been in the last three games. You know, they're trying to attack more. They're trying to pass shorter. They're defending better as well. And I'm not privy to what went on behind the scenes and what members of that squad thought about Sean Dyche. Maybe it's just a case that things went a little bit stale.
Poor Scholes knows.
Yeah, he'll have his intel. But you can't doubt the statistics. I don't believe that they would have taken 7 points from the last three games with Sean Dyche in charge, and they have now, which ergo makes it the right decision, I suppose.
I think Mike Jackson is just trusting the players, and sometimes that can have a really galvanising effect. Under Sean Dyche, it was about the system, it was about their style, their philosophy, and I don't think some of the new signings loved it, to be perfectly honest, especially chasing 30, 40 channel balls every single game. I think the subtle little differences here, and Daniel's touched on it, is give it to someone's feet. It's fine. Trust them to take a touch. He can look after it. He's a good player. And he'll give it to somebody else. And they've shortened up their game, you know, noticeably, and it's made a difference. I think the other tactical tweak is putting Dwight McNeil on the right. I think there was a reluctance from Sean Dyche to do that. And in the last couple of games, he's been on the right. And he sometimes just a change of scenery. I was a winger that played on the left or the right. Sometimes just a change of scenery, just flipping it to the other side, just changes the whole picture. You feel a different player. And he certainly looks reinvigorated. I mean, Dwight McNeil, when he's got the ball at his feet and he's in good form, he reminds me of Ryan Giggs when he was younger. The way that he travels across the turf, he's not in that class, but he's an exciting player that really hasn't had enough of the ball at his feet this season. So those little changes have definitely helped. And yeah, they look a different team. The fixtures are kind as well. I think Southampton and Wolves weren't the toughest pair of home games, but fair play to Burnley for winning them.
All right, Watford's not the trickiest of away trips either. Alarm bells ringing for Everton, possibly Rory for Leeds as well. They're only 2 points above Burnley now. They're at Palace Monday night, of course, where they can improve that.
Yeah, of course, they haven't played since the Boer War, so it's hard to tell what sort of form they're in. They whenever their last game was, which was a lot, I think it was 3 weeks ago, that there was, which they won, they beat Watford, I think, at home. And there was this sense of relief, but also vague trepidation, as they knew that if results went against them before they played again, which was Palace on Monday night, that they could theoretically be in the bottom three. And it's not quite worked out like that. But it's not much better, because Burnley have found this vein of form, as Daniel and Adrian have said, that you probably weren't expecting when Leeds last played. And so it now looks like they probably need a couple of wins rather than maybe just one to be absolutely secure and safe in the Premier League. They've got Palace away, is it? Adrian just mentioned that, you know, Southampton Wolves this time of the season, probably not a bad sort of team to be playing. I'd probably put Palace in that category as well. Although weirdly, if Leeds beat Palace... This is not great for time-limited content, I apologise. But if Leeds beat Palace, I think they're only 2 points behind them, which, given that you'd assume that Palace are completely safe and Leeds are not, maybe suggest that both those things aren't quite accurate.
But it'd be only 1 point behind them.
Is it only one? Mm. We've made it clear that I don't really understand how the table works already, so that's fine. I think that they need to beat Palace, because it's City after that, and that is not the sort of fixture you need. Yeah. And I think Leeds don't need to be going into May thinking we have to get 2 wins out of 3 or 2 wins out of 4. That's a lot of pressure, but they are still in it. And to be honest, I wouldn't have said that Brentford and Palace Villa and Palace are completely clear yet either.
Well, Villa are what, 8 points?
I was just about to say, if we're bringing in teams to the relegation discussion, Villa are the next cab on that rank, partly because they've taken 1 point from the last 5 games, and also because, crucially, they've still got to play Burnley home and away. They haven't played Burnley yet this season. They're sort of a bogey team. I think they've only won one of the last 6 against Burnley. If they lose both those games, then I think Burnley will finish ahead of Villa. The question is whether Everton and Leeds get enough points to make a difference, I suppose.
Well, huge weekend coming up. And, of course, Monday night, that Palace-Leeds game could prove very significant as well. As for Liverpool, they moved back to a point behind Man City, who previously on Saturday had given Watford what for, made the D in Watford optional, all those things. 5-1 the scoreline at the Etihad. 4 of those goals and the assist from the other coming from, again, a player who's on his way out, Gabriel Jesus.
Yeah, I like him as a player. I really do. I've always thought he's a finisher, Gabriel Jesus, but he obviously showed it in this game. But he'd only had 3 Premier League goals before this match, which just seems remarkable, really. They showed on Match of the Day, didn't they, his minutes per goal ratio in a City shirt. It is second best, only to Sergio Aguero. So he's a guy that should probably play more and that should probably be given more starts. But it's not happened for reasons that are obvious, because they've got so many other sensational players, and because of the fact that Gabriel Jesus almost turned his nose up at the prospect of being the main striker in the team. I think he said to Pep Guardiola he's happy to be a wide forward now. He's down the pecking order, but it was his day, wasn't it? And my favourite goal was the second one that was supplied by De Bruyne. If you closed your eyes and sort of just fantasized about a De Bruyne assist, it would be that one. You just think, well, it's right corner of the box. It's an absolute whip of a cross. The ball's not going to move in the air. It's not going to spin that much. It's just going to go directly onto the head of someone, and that's what it was. It was a dream assist from De Bruyne, and the most predictable 5-1 win, I think, of the season. I think most people were probably tipping 4 or 5.
Do you often close your eyes and fantasize about this?
All the time.
Do
all
you?
The time. Yeah,
what would just be your dream, you know, when it's you? I don't know. What's your dream scenario?
Well, I do remember an assist from, it might even have been a youth team game. Honestly, I can't remember what happened.
Is this like Romario and Pele claiming goals they've scored in their gardens?
Exactly.
Is it an assist that you produced in your garden?
You've asked me the question. I'm pulling out the dream assist that I remember. I can't remember last week. I can't remember the week before. But I can remember an assist where I did a roulette that was perfectly timed to drag the ball back, to spin and drag the ball back as the defender slid in. So he slides past me as I drag the ball back. And then I produced the De Bruyne cross for someone to head in. That's the assist that I remember. I might have been 14. But
defender/youngest child. I mean, potato, potato.
I know that none of you care about this, but James asked me, and that is the dream assist.
All right, nice one. Somewhere Michael Owen is talking about his penalty against a 13-year-old in similar terms. Adrian, it's going to be hard for the rest of the show to live up to that. Let's see. On the subject of City, Watford... City now with their 15th consecutive win in all competitions against Watford, which is the first time any English league team has done that to another English league team. All right.
26 goals in their last five games against Watford, Manchester
against
City.
Watford. Okay. Next up, let's move on to Arsenal.
It's semi-final time of the Champions League, listeners. Tuesday night sees Real Madrid make the trip to Eastlands after collecting the scalps of both PSG and Chelsea. If Real are going to win what would be their fifth European Cup in eight seasons, they are certainly going to have to do it the hard way, as Pep Guardiola's Manchester City stand in their way. Karim Benzema has 14 goals in his last 10 in all competitions and has been a match-winning superstar for Los Blancos this season. The Frenchman is no surprise the 6-4 favourite to win the Ballon d'Or. Guardiola will have to find a way to limit his influence, or just like Tuchel and Pochettino, you'll have to watch the Champions League final on the TV. In terms of the betting, Manchester City are the 4-9 favourites. The draw is 7-2, and Real are 11-2. Big price. Wednesday night sees Liverpool take on Villarreal. The Reds come into the game against the Yellow Submarine, having beaten Everton and both Manchester clubs in their last three games. So confidence and morale will be sky high for Klopp's men. There is small hope for Villarreal, though. Unai Emery has shown once again that he is indeed a very good manager. But take a look at the ex-Cherry Arnaud Danjuma in the goal-scoring markets. He's 10-1 to be the first goal scorer. He scored against Bayern Munich, and he's 16-5 any time, and that looks a shrewd bet. Liverpool are 1-4, the draw is 9-2, and Villarreal are priced at 10-1. You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com, or indeed the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s. T's and C's apply. BeGambleAware.org. And remember, take time to think.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Totally Football Show European Edition is going to be out when you wake up on Tuesday, listener, depending on your, you know, nocturnal habits. Among the diverse topics, might get a word or two about Pochettino exiting PSG and Antonio Conte and a possible swap move. We'll definitely be talking about those Champions League semi-finals. As I mentioned, Rory and Dan, you're both going along to Anfield on Wednesday to see the Yellow Submarine, you know, at its spiritual home, Merseyside. They are the team that keeps defying expectations. And Adrian, I'm sure you'll have a view on this as well. Can they do it to Liverpool?
Well, Villarreal are more capable of spoiling a game at Anfield than Everton, that is for sure. They're masters at being well-drilled and hard to break down, aren't they? It's, you know what it's going to be. It'll be a narrow 4-4-2. And they will leave zero space between the defence and the midfield. There'll just be none. There'll be no dropping into pockets to pick up the ball. They won't be able to do that. So Liverpool will have to be patient and work out a way. It might be that they win it off the bench again. It might be that Klopp can afford to lose one of his three central midfielders and put an extra man in attack just to throw a curveball in. It's going to be a fascinating match tactically. But they've had a nice warm-up, Liverpool, in terms of having to break down a team that's set up to be difficult to prize open. The difference with Villarreal is they've got more punch, a little bit more punch on the counter, and they will have that threat. That for me is what Everton lacked in the game. So yeah, they've got a chance here. They are the sort of team I would suggest that Liverpool don't enjoy playing.
I think that's absolutely right. There's a tendency to see Liverpool as having an easy run to the Champions League final, which is both presumptuous and I think slightly disrespectful, particularly to Villarreal. Benfica was a kind draw compared to what you might have had. But Villarreal beat Bayern Munich, and they didn't do that by chance. They beat them comfortably in Spain. And to be honest, 1-0 flattered Bayern from that leg. And, you know, they had to ride their luck a little bit in the second leg, and they nicked the goal through Chukwueze in the 87th minute. But again, it's not by chance. They're not kind of fluting their way to it. They are incredibly well organised. There aren't really any stars to this Villarreal team. Someone said to me the other day that it's a team of functionaries, that everyone's own particular ability is kind of subsumed into the collective. So they will make it really difficult for Liverpool. I don't think this is a semi-final like the one against Roma in 2018 that ended 5-2 at Anfield, then 4-2 to Roma in the Olympico, and they were just, it kind of, everyone just had a great time in that semi-final. It was just really good fun. Liverpool and Roma just wanted to put on a show. Villarreal don't care about the show. They are effective. They've got options. They've got depth. They're really well coached. It will be probably quite an unattractive two games. But the fact that Villarreal have put out Bayern and Juve means that by definition cannot be an easy route to the final. They deserve far more respect than that, I think.
What about the Real Madrid game? Man City on Wednesday. Real Madrid, who I think surprised a lot of people with that stirring 3-1 victory at Stamford Bridge to set up their route to this semi. Although possibly we take a slightly different, or we see that in a slightly different light with Chelsea's recent travails and their current predicament. What do you think, though, City?
I think it'll be really interesting, particularly the first leg, because it looks like, or it sounds like, Kyle Walker and John Stones might be out injured, and João Cancelo is suspended, which means I suspect that Real will try and do exactly the same they did at Stamford Bridge, which is get Vinicius to run down that right wing, because we don't know who's going to be playing right back for City. You'd normally think it would be Ruben Diaz, but given that there are absentees at centre back as well, maybe Guardiola will want Diaz at centre back. So they'll try and get Vinicius down that left, and they'll try and find space for Karim Benzema. I suspect they'll try and do an exact carbon copy. And I do fancy City, but I think it will be mighty close, this one.
Goals. It screams goals, doesn't it, over two legs. I think that Real Madrid have got the strength to hurt Manchester City in behind, as Daniel's touched on. But in midfield, City should be completely dominant in midfield, in my opinion. As brilliant as Modric was against Chelsea at the end of that game, I still think that City's engine room is kind of... they're almost in their peak years, and Real Madrid's are a little bit, you know, I don't like to say over the hill, but they're past their peak, for sure. I think that might be where it's ultimately won or lost. But yeah, goals at both ends, I think.
Mm. Could see Zinchenko back in a full-back or wing-back role. A tackle of the weekend from him, admittedly against Watford, but what a recovery run that was on Saturday. Two fascinating, I believe is the term, midweek Champions League clashes. Let's talk about the teams that are chasing a role in this conversation next season, chasing top four places, well, really fourth spot, or maybe third as well. This is probably down to just two contenders now, Arsenal and Spurs, after Arsenal's 3-1 win Saturday lunchtime over Man United. Rory, not sure if you were having your tea, stroke lunch at this time.
I was having my lunch and watching the game.
Nice. Daniel was actually there. Well done, Daniel. What a week, Daniel, for Arsenal.
Yeah, a week ago I said they've lost three in a row, so it's all over. You know, I don't think I did say it's all over. I said I'm not stupid enough to say it's all over this time. And thankfully, for once, I kept my mouth shut, and it was proved to be a correct thing to do, because both games against Chelsea and Manchester United, it's really strange to me is that Arteta obsesses, as so many managers do, about this idea of control and how to get fluidity within a controlled system. And his main key is by using these brilliant attacking midfielders in Erdegaard and in Saka and in Smith Rowe. And there's no doubt over the last two games that there has been too much chaos for Arteta's liking. But it feels, in hindsight, like he felt that was the only way to get something new, to change the message. And it's worked because they've won both games. They were hugely fortunate to beat a rotten Manchester United team. You know, Bruno misses a penalty at a crucial time. Bruno loses the ball at the edge of the box at a crucial time. Cristiano Ronaldo is marginally offside at a crucial time. And they could very easily have lost that game 3-1. But this is the stage of the season where you would expect Arteta to do nothing but tell you that he doesn't care because the result is the king and they win. And you're right, they put Manchester United out of that top four race. And with Tottenham suddenly, you know, shot on targetless again, they probably are favourites now. Again,
maybe even have Chelsea's third spot in their sights. Among the things that went right for them, I mean, a list that started early on with Nuno Tavares with his first goal for Arsenal after just 3 minutes and some classic Man United defending there. But then at 2-1, United with the chance to equalise when Bruno Fernandes steps up to the spot. Adrian, can I ask you about that technique which we saw Jorginho on Sunday against West Ham with similarly disastrous results? Which was a worse penalty? And why do you think it is that that penalty is now proving so very, very disastrous?
I think the goalkeepers have seen too much of it, haven't they? And they know that these players want to wait. They know that if the players are effectively eyeballing the goalkeepers, aren't they, as they're going to approach the ball, waiting for them to blink or to show which way they want to move. And then at the very last moment, without really looking at the ball, they pick their spot. And it's worked for a while, but I feel that this style of penalty has to be on the way out because goalkeepers know it. And Fabianski pretty much said so, didn't he, afterwards? Mm. I don't know if you saw the interview he did with Julien Laurent.
Let's listen.
Is it the worst penalty that you've ever saved? That was bad.
I don't know, to be honest, I have this thing for some really bad penalties, because if you look at the last season, the Lookman penalty wasn't a good one as well. So I don't know what it is. I don't know if that's my presence or something that scares them.
It was great, and he basically threw his hat on it, didn't he? He knew what was coming, and it was the softest penalty ever. So no, the worst one was Bruno because he misses the target.
But the thing? Because you wait so long, the shot when it comes is inevitably so soft.
I don't think you can generate power from a skip, can you? I hand on heart, I don't think I've ever tried this penalty. I've never tried that technique. But
only in
for
your
me,
fantasies. For,
yeah, exactly. To generate power, you need to plant your foot better. And in my book, a penalty should be you know, as firmly struck as possible. But these guys have got away with it for a long time. But it feels like the game's up.
Do you know? I remember saying around the time of the Euros final that Pickford, I said it maybe slightly too harshly, but Pickford savouring from Jorginho in the shootout isn't actually that impressive because goalkeepers should by now have worked out what Jorginho's going to do. And I'm slightly surprised it's taken this long for it to happen. Because Jorginho can alternate if he realises the keeper's not moving. He can kind of pick a corner and hit it with power. But 9 times out of 10, he's waiting and waiting and waiting and rolling. And I'm amazed more goalkeepers don't think, do you know what, I will just stand still and see what happens.
Right. Jan Sommer, crucially for Switzerland, very much has worked Jorginho out, which is kind of the main reason that Italy aren't going to the World Cup. No goalkeeper was stopping Granit Xhaka's shot, though. A whole 3.5 minutes after he pulled off another of his trademark tricks, that wonderful 50th Premier League yellow card. But that shot, crikey.
Yeah, can I just say where I was when Arsenal played Manchester United? I was going down some flumes in Lanzarote that were designed for 4-5-year-olds max. And having great fun doing so, I have to say.
Thanks, Adrian.
So that was what I was doing. But I have watched the game back.
Good. Okay.
And it was a rasper, wasn't it, from Granit Xhaka? It was a real drill of a shot. It's something he's capable of. And he had a good game. And I think he's had a good week with the Chelsea performance as well. So, yeah, Xhaka and Elneny reunited, kind of surprisingly, because Elneny hasn't had a kick for months, and it's worked all right. So no, it was a great strike, and in a way, the strike was aggressive, wasn't it? It was firmly struck, and for me, Arsenal's success this season or otherwise is dependent on their ability to do one specific thing really well, and that's play with aggression. They're not good enough to win games playing the ball around nicely and playing softly and not getting in the faces of oppositions and maybe not playing with a little element of chaos.
Mm.
They need to, when they play with aggression, without the ball, you know, closing players down properly, you know, just being forceful, and when they have the ball, shifting it quickly, moving dynamically, moving with purpose, they're faster, stronger, infinitely more dangerous, and they create space.
Mm.
And for those star men like Saka and Odegaard and Smith Rowe. So it's all about playing with aggression. If Arsenal can do that often enough between now and the end of the season, they'll finish fourth.
Right.
If they don't, they won't.
Where are the Arsenal fans on Xhaka at the moment? Do they hate him again? Do they love him again? Have they stopped hating him and started loving him again? Is it a love-hate thing? Is it a hate-love thing? I'm amazed that in 20 actual 22, Granit Xhaka scored from 25 yards for Arsenal and everyone cheered. Yeah. It's amazing. Like it's literally less than 6 months since they were demanding he was like booted out of the club.
Yeah, it's such a fluctuating relationship, isn't it? I think there are certain parts of the Arsenal fan base that will never like Granit Xhaka. They just won't. But they'll still find it within themselves to cheer that goal, of course, or celebrate it. But no, he's back in vogue. And he's back in vogue because he's Arsenal's best midfielder at the moment. Thomas Partey's out. Lokonga is a work in progress. Elneny is Elneny. He's the best option. So you've got to get behind him. And yeah, there are lots of good features about Granit Xhaka's game that I admire. But the bottom line is that there is still that feeling that over the course of a season, he will let you down at key moments four or five times. And for that reason, I don't think he's the answer long term. I think they will look past him. But in the here and now, he's absolutely integral to this team. And the Arsenal fans know it. And there's no way they're going to get on his back. No chance.
Do you remember the story about the house keys with Granit Xhaka? Daniel will. Will remember.
His little brother, wasn't it?
Yeah, so the story was that Granit is the younger brother of Taulant Xhaka, who plays for, I think, did he play for Kosovo or Albania? Plays for someone who's not Switzerland and has had a kind of decent career, not as spectacular as Granit's. But because Granit was so responsible, his parents used to leave the house keys with Granit rather than Taulant. And in the way that journalism works is that when you get a little fact like that, you imbue it with enormous explanatory power. And that was taken when Xhaka signed for Arsenal as, so this is who they're getting. They're getting the kid
keys
with the
to
keys.
The midfield. Yeah.
He's so responsible because his parents gave him the keys that he'll be able to take on all the pressure of Arsenal. And I think it's hilarious that in all that time since, that's exactly the opposite of what's happened, that Xhaka has continually done incredibly irresponsible things.
Throwing the keys down the drain.
We don't know what happened when his parents returned home, having given Granit the keys. They might
that's
well have
true,
found
yeah.
the house a smouldering. smouldering, but anyway, there you go. We've spoken a lot about Man United, so why don't we hear from former United legend Paul Scholes?
It's a disaster of a dressing room. I had a quick chat with Jesse there. I'm sure he won't mind me saying it. Dressing room's just a disaster.
Yeah, extraordinary moment that. I don't know if you've caught that on social media. That's Paul Scholes on, was it DAZN Canada? Certainly on DAZN. Just dropping Jesse Lingard in it, presumably, or by now is the situation so far gone that no one's going to care either way?
Well, I think it is, because subsequently, or roughly at the same time, Scott McTominay was telling journalists that there are a whole load of problems at United in terms of players, staff and everything higher up, which kind of reminded me of that David Moyes quote about passing, defending and attacking. And, you know, you sort of wanted to tap Scott and say, well, yeah, you've covered everybody there, and he's right, everything is broken. And it does feel in over the last week or so that Ralf Rangnick's job has inadvertently or otherwise shifted to being this, you know, he's clearly not been a very good interim coach. We sort of shifted to being this sort of hot take truth teller on just how bad Manchester United is behind the scenes, in the hope that Erik ten Hag will come in and at least everyone will accept that they're at rock bottom and therefore they need to give him some control. Whether they will or not is a much more complicated question. But it does seem like Rangnick shifted from, OK, I'm not going to get to do the long-term stuff. I've not done the short-term stuff very well, so maybe I'll just talk about everything that's stopped me from doing both.
Can I just say, we've hammered Bruno Fernandes for his penalty miss. The tackle on Tavares, I don't think we should let that slide, really. And for me, that tackle is a byproduct of the environment in the Manchester United dressing room. Now, I remember coming on this podcast, I think very early on in the season, when Paul Pogba had pretty much down tools with Ollie. It might have been last season at some point, where everyone was doing what they wanted. There was no accountability and he was switching off, making daft challenges here, there and everywhere. And I think that's creeping back into the United dressing room. When everyone's so fed up with each other, fed up with the situation, they lose focus and they just lose sight of normal things. And that was a tackle of a... It wasn't even a tackle, was it? That was a malicious piece of play on Bruno Fernandes' part, born out of the frustration of being part of the shambles that is Manchester United at the moment. And the only thing that was a bigger shambles was the fact that Jared Gillett on VAR didn't do anything about it. That is a horrendous piece of officiating. That is the clearest red card I think I've seen all season. And it just beggars belief that he got away with it.
Well, while Man United's miseries continue, Arsenal now just 5 points behind Chelsea in the Premier League. Next up, in fact, let's talk about Chelsea and their clash with Arsenal's next opponent, West Ham.
So, Mr. Guardiola, what's troubling you?
I'm very tired, Doctor.
Tired, right?
No, I'm very tired of winning. It's just too easy at the moment, you know? I need a challenge.
Like finally winning the Champions League with Man City?
Hey, come on.
Will Pep finally do it? At Paddy Power, we can't guarantee you a trophy, but we can guarantee you money back as a free bet if one leg of your 4+4 bet builder lets you down. Paddy Power!
Pre-match online bet builder bets only. Min odds 1 to 5 per leg. Max free bet £10 per day. 7-day free bet expiry. Excludes enhanced match odds. Eligibility restrictions and T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Alonso. Pulisic!
All right, Chelsea 1, West Ham 0 on Sunday. West Ham, who have Eintracht Frankfurt on Thursday. So David Moyes actually resting some big players for this, although Declan Rice came on. Miguel Antonio and Bowen also were substitutes. But Chelsea kind of drifting badly before Christian Pulisic's 90th minute winner in this one. Is this just because they've only really got the FA Cup to worry about now? Is it because of the ongoing limbo that the club finds itself off the field, Antonio Rudiger leaving as a fruit of that whole Abramovich sanctioned business? What do you think?
It was a really important win, first and foremost, that Pulisic goal does probably make Chelsea safe in third. Whereas if they'd drawn, you would have been looking at it and thinking, do you know what, Arsenal or potentially Spurs might be able to catch them and they might miss out on the Champions League entirely. The main factor has to be the fact that they're out of the Champions League, they know they're not going to win the title, there's a little bit of a kind of reduction in energy levels that is unavoidable. We're seeing it a little bit with other teams in mid-table who've run out of things to play for as well. I suspect the disappointment of going out to Real Madrid after putting all that energy into the second leg, producing a performance that good and getting nothing for it, that might be a factor. I don't know how much I believe that the players are affected by the takeover, partly because they're going to get paid either way. Like, they don't really care. It's not like they're all Roman Abramovich's close friends. I think that the uncertainty probably had an impact initially. I think Tuchel did really well to help them ride that wave. I don't know why it would be the case that six weeks, eight weeks later, they suddenly go, hang on, what is this about the owner? That seems really unlikely to me. I do think, though, something has shifted a bit at Chelsea. They don't look like the incredibly well-drilled, slick outfit that they did for basically the first year of Tuchel's tenure. They seem a little bit more ragged. The idea isn't as clear. There's lots of, even Tuchel himself, there's lots of kind of, well, I'll do this now, and I'll do this now, and I'll do this now. It seems much more random. It doesn't seem quite as finely tuned as it was. And I wonder whether that's partly to do with the fact that you do have not just Rudiger, but Christensen out of contract. You've got Azpilicueta, who's considering going. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty. Lukaku, the bid striker. Werner apparently wants to leave as well. So there's kind of a lot going on where you look at United and think there's lots of players there who clearly don't want to be there, and you see the kind of shambles that they've become. I wonder if there's just a very small version of that happening at Chelsea.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think that we're used to seeing mid-table teams gaining that reputation for kind of on the beach or playing in flip-flops. I think when it happens with a higher class team like Chelsea, it becomes much more obvious when people aren't quite at their best. And I think Roy's absolutely right. I think that Rudiger situation is pretty indicative of what's happening, because it was clear that we are told that he was prepared to sign a new contract in February. It is now clear, Tuchel has even admitted that he's going to leave in the summer. And I wonder if that just sends a message, almost a sort of subconscious message to those other players of, oh, if someone's jumping ship, someone very totemic in that Chelsea team and in their cup success over the last few years is prepared to want to leave, and is so prepared to want to leave that he is announcing it before the end of the season. That must make a difference in a dressing room, and it doesn't make them an easy squad to manage, which Tuchel's brilliance during his Chelsea tenure is being able to kind of wipe away all that noise and manage them like a football team.
In a dressing room, you need to feel part of something. You want to feel that you're all together as one, driving for the same thing. And the fact is that Rudiger's got his eye on something else now, and so's Christensen and other players. This is the problem with letting players run down their contracts that are part of your first team, that focus that does go at some point, particularly when there's nothing to play for but an FA Cup final. So I think this is quite predictable, really. And you see it a lot in the EFL, actually, where contracts are much shorter. You get to this stage of the season, and players just aren't in it. Their heads aren't there. And for that reason, you get a lot of strange results.
All right. What if it's not a player, but the manager? A manager like Antonio Conte at Spurs, who suddenly ran out of gas, parked on the hard shoulder of the top four race. 0-0 at Brentford, second game in a row. They failed to have a shot on target. Have people worked out Spurs, or is it the fact that Antonio's allegedly touting himself to Paris Saint-Germain?
That doesn't feel coincidental. The Spurs were looking really good before Brighton. You looked at that front three and thought Son, Kane, Kulusevski, way better than what Arsenal have got. It's better than what Manchester United have got. It's probably the way it functions, probably a better front three than Chelsea's, to be perfectly honest. And you looked at that and thought, right, they should sail to the top four because Arsenal are so unpredictable. They could even decide the title. They've got to go to Anfield, I think, the first week of May. That suddenly had the air of, right, well, that's the game that Liverpool are going to really struggle with. And then they've just stopped. And there's no real explanation for it. I think the players are too good to be worked out properly. I mean, Son and Kane have created and scored more goals with each other than anybody else in Premier League history. It would be weird if suddenly people were like, hang on, this is how we stop them.
No, but Brentford's idea, what was it, Pontus Janssen sticking him on Harry Kane, which is, yeah, I guess, not rocket science, but was that particularly effective this time?
I think that helps. And, you know, obviously they are stoppable, but the fact that you'd suddenly, at the same time, you get yet again Conte, kind of the rumours floating around that he's at, oh, PSG could be coming up. And I think Miguel Delaney suggested that there might even be effectively a swap where Conte goes to PSG and Pochettino comes back to Spurs. It just feels slightly, the timing is interesting that Spurs have this dip and suddenly Conte's not that committed anymore. And whether that's cause or symptom, I don't know. But it that's not a great recipe either, where the manager, every time there's a bit of a setback, the manager's like, hang on, maybe I don't want to be here. That's not what you need.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally. You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. And that's good news for Watford fans as they get ready to appoint their fourth manager of the season. Pre-match bet builders only, get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4 plus legs. Maximum free bet is £10. Excludes enhanced match odds. Online exclusives and T's and C's apply.
Also out in the next few days, you've got your Totally Football League show. Adrian, you're in that. With Matt Davis Adams. That's out actually Monday. Ooh, dramatic weekend for Oldham Athletic. They've become the first former Premier League team to be relegated to the National League.
And the final, I don't know if you saw this, the game was held. It took about 4 hours to complete the game.
What?
Fans protesting against the ownership who've, you know, run the club into the ground, Lim Segum brothers, deeply unpopular. And they came onto the pitch with, I think, 12 minutes to go and they wouldn't get off. And in the end, they had to empty the stadium and the final 12 minutes was played behind closed doors, which was pretty depressing sight, really, for the club who are heading into the National League. But yeah, every year there's one crisis club in the EFL or in League Two that's run terribly and that
one.
Team almost invariably goes out of the league.
Yeah. And then for clubs like Oldham and Scunthorpe, who are not quite as an extreme situation, but a sort of slower death rather than a quicker one, it's so, so hard to get back up next season if they don't change that promotion picture, because there are clubs who are infinitely better run than them in the league below. And so they will just get clogged up in non-league or National League mid-table.
Mm. Also out on Tuesday, the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. Among the topics in that, the Women's Champions League semi-final first legs, which featured another huge result for Barcelona Femini in front of another huge crowd. 5-1 against Wolfsburg.
Yeah, these are becoming massive events, probably the best footballing events in Catalonia at the moment, given that the men seem to keep losing at home. I think they beat the record by a few hundred. It can't have been by much more than that because obviously the Camp Nou was full. They can't have built any more seats. But yeah, a dominant performance against Wolfsburg by Barça Femení. All things being equal, they should face Lyon in the final. They beat PSG 3-2 on Sunday, which was a much tighter game, a much more dramatic game. The decisive goal, I think, was the a terrible mistake by the PSG keeper, a kind of Zach Steffen-esque mistake by the PSG keeper. And Barca-Lyon would be a really sort of narrative-rich final. That was, you know, it's the team that established this idea of the original Galacticos in women's football against the team that has taken their mantle. You've got Lyon desperate to prove a point that they were for a long time the greatest team women's football had seen. Barca came along, win a treble and kind of take that crown from them. And Lyon, I don't think, have taken that particularly well. So obviously it's only 3-2, the Lyon-PSG game, but So PSG are not out of it by any stretch of the imagination, but Barca-Lyon in the final would have a real sense of occasion about it.
Mm. Well, more on that come Tuesday and the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. Before we wrap up today, obviously there were other Premier League matches that took place this weekend. Norwich losing 3-0 at home to Newcastle. Woof, that Joe Linton brace. Brighton with a 2-2 draw against Southampton after being 2-0 up, the Seagulls, and the goalless Leicester-Aston Villa game. What would you fancy discussing here, Daniel?
Another mention for Joe Linton, I think. We've talked about his redemption in recent weeks as a central midfielder. This almost feels like the final kind of panel of that redemption, in that Eddie Howe chose to make a number of changes, including resting Chris Wood and put Joe Linton up as a striker again. And having regained confidence in midfield, I think he'd scored twice from 41 shots before Saturday. He then goes back to being a striker again. And because he's full of confidence, he scores 2 from 3 shots, including, as you say, the first was a brilliant finish with his right. The second will probably please Eddie Howe more, because it was a kind of poacher's goal with his left foot. And I mean, we should say Norwich, the defending by Norwich for that first goal is just, I mean, it's sort of 7 ways of terrible. It's just, that's why they're going down this season. It's a complete, like, I mean, I broke it down for the score, but it's just a cavalcade of men not tracking their runners and not noticing opposition players, and then missing their kicks. And yes, it's a spectacular finish, but Norwich are something else in terms of shooting themselves in the foot.
Is Eddie Howe a manager of the year contender? I mean, only City and Liverpool have accrued more points per game this year. They're 5th since he took charge. So if the table was to, you know, from matches just since he took charge, they'd be 5th. This is a team that were bottom when he took charge. Yes, he had a transfer window where we got to spend a fair bit of money, and Bruno Guimaraes is looking like a great investment, isn't he, in particular. But I just think that the way that he's coached that team, given largely the same group of players, the confidence to go out and play on the Premier League stage and express themselves in a way that they were never allowed to before, I think that deserves huge kudos. I think that Eddie Howe's stock, I don't think it could get much higher than it is right now. I think he's got to be in the frame, at least. Mm. Probably the manager that wins the title will walk away with Manager of the Year. But for the job that he's done and the turnaround, Eddie Howe would get my vote if I was to get one.
Do you know, as a point of principle, it would be easy to tell Adrian who's being ridiculous. But having just flipped through the through the table, there isn't really another outstanding candidate, because he's right that it will end up being Guardiola or Klopp. But I'm not quite sure whether that is the point of things like the Manager of the Year award or the Player of the Year award. That there is an award that you get for being the person who has created the best team in the league, and that award is called the Premier League Trophy. And I always think that the individual award should be more to do with kind of people's achievements relative to their status, almost. How much have you affected your team? So for the Young Player of the Year, it will be Phil Foden. But it should probably be Conor Gallagher, because he's had the most impact on his team, even though Palace are 14th and aren't going to win the title.
Saka?
Or someone like Saka maybe would be a good shout as well. With the manager, the only person really who you could make a case has done a better job than Howe, and partly it's because of the fact it's over the course of the season, is probably David Moyes. There isn't anybody else who you look at in that table. Bruno Lage has done a good job. Klopp and Guardiola have met expectations. But there's no one. There probably isn't an outstanding candidate. Thomas Frank at Brentford?
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention. Maybe Frank. Just for doing it over the full... I mean, they're 3 points behind Newcastle now, and Howe's obviously been brilliant since he took over. I wonder if that kind of over the whole season work, and with the kind of rejuvenation or return of Christian Eriksen, I think that plays in his favour as well from a voting point of view. I wonder if Frank might get it.
Fair enough.
Can I also make a point on Norwich?
Please do.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
There was an interview in the Times with Stuart Webber, the sporting director, on Saturday morning. And Stuart Webber's been one of those people who people like me and Daniel have praised to the hilt for their sort of sensible work and how clever they are. And it's become that kind of fashion. I shouldn't really drag Daniel into it, but...
yeah, cheers, that, mate.
That kind Scholes-esque there.
it's become that fashionable thing to say, aren't Norwich well run? Hasn't Stuart Webber done a good job? Isn't they clever?
Sounds like me, annoyingly.
And it definitely sounds like me. And he gave this interview in which there was a couple of weird lines. He kind of said it's not his job to appease Norwich fans. I think that is literally his job, is to appease the fans of the club that he is running. And it all felt very kind of self-exculpatory. And I really find it odd that you could sort of pitch yourself as that in a season in which Norwich's whole kind of, not logic, but their methods, but Norwich's whole kind of accepted acquiescence to their role as kind of the yo-yo team has been totally exploded as nonsense. If Brentford can stay up, Norwich can stay up. At which point you have to say, why aren't Norwich staying up? Why are you running a club that seems unable to remain in the Premier League when Brentford have made it not necessarily look easy, but prove certainly that it can be done on a budget that I suspect is smaller than Norwich's? And I find it really strange that there appears to still be this kind of acceptance that Norwich are doing all they can, which is a point of view that I had until relatively recently. But ultimately, the evidence changes. Your opinion should change when the evidence changes, and the evidence suggests that what Norwich are doing is not the limit of their, should not be the limit of their ambitions. And I feel as though that question probably has to be asked at some point, not necessarily of Dean Smith, who came in this season, but certainly higher up.
I think there's also a, and I know Watford fans certainly think that, I think when teams get sort of rooted perennially to the bottom of the table, there's an almost a kind of acceptance that there's nothing, as you say, there's nothing more you can do, and also that relegation was an inevitability. And Watford fans are very quick to point out, you know, we're still only 7 points, or we were before this weekend, 6 points from safety. And we've been playing dreadfully at home all season and away from home on and off for most of the season. And we're still only 7 points from safety. I think this season, more than any other, was a real chance for Watford and Norwich to be better, because the bottom six in the Premier League now have all changed their manager this season. So all of them were in enough of a crisis at some point that they felt they had to make a significant change. And yet, even despite that, they're still going to be cut adrift at the bottom, which is not unforgivable because it's hard, but there are things they could have done better, certainly.
Speaking of things that could have been done better, as I mentioned, there's also Leicester's goalless draw with Aston Villa. Remarkable stat, courtesy of producer Charlie. This was Leicester's 50th game of the season. They've played 15 more games than their opponents on Saturday, Aston Villa.
That's the effect of the Conference League. This game should have been called off after 15 minutes when it became abundantly clear that nobody was interested in it whatsoever. I did BT Sports score on Saturday afternoon, and this was the game Robbie Savage was deputed to watch, obviously the former Leicester legend in inverted commas. And anyone who's met Robbie Savage knows he's an ebullient, lively, outspoken sort of person. And even he, by the end of it, seemed to be bordering on clinical depression. He was devastated to have watched it. And I think that in those circumstances, fans should either be given a full refund and invited back for a better performance, or the game should be called off after 20 minutes when it becomes clear that it's just not working.
Right. Well, another level of excitement was the 2-2 draw between Brighton and Southampton just to wrap up the Premier League weekend, with Saints coming back from 2-0 down. And that was courtesy of that James Ward-Prowse brace.
Sadly, the main takeaway from the game for me was that what looked a pretty horrific injury for Tino Livramento, who kind of got oxygen as he left the pitch, and Hasenhüttl was sort of consoling him. The worst time of the season to get injured, I think, because it can ruin, especially for a young player, because it then, I mean, Adrian will know more than me, but it can ruin the pre-season that's then coming up. And if you miss the start of the next season, you feel like you're playing catch-up almost for the whole season, which is, I mean, he's massively talented. He'll get through it as long as he recovers fully. But, real, real sad. But especially, it almost feels worse in a game that neither side needed to win and didn't really matter.
Yeah. No, it's going to be a long road back. But he's young enough to come back and be just as good. Tino Livramento, one of the signings of the season, no doubt about it. On James Ward-Prowse, very quickly, that hammer right foot of his is something else, isn't it? He's a unique talent, especially from the dead balls. And I was thinking about this. It just made me think of it last night after I watched it, and obviously all the stats were doing the rounds about how amazing his dead ball record is. I just think he has to be in the World Cup squad. I think he has to be in it, just because there will be an occasion during that tournament where England are chasing a goal with 20 minutes left to play, And I think he's every bit as proficient in central midfield, or he can be over a 20-minute period, as a Declan Rice, as a Calvin Phillips, as, you know, as any of these, as a Jordan Henderson. But you've got the benefit of the guy who, should you get a foul inside the final third, can come up and deliver a big moment. He would be absolutely in my squad, almost regardless of form.
Really? What is his strike rate on free kicks?
Well, he scored more direct free kicks this season than anyone else. That's 5. He's got 9 since the start of last season. I think he's got more direct free kick goals than anyone across Europe's top 5 leagues. And it's not just the free kicks. It's obviously his quality deliveries from wide free kicks, from corners, and his ability to score from the edge of the box, like he did in the game against Brighton. So I just think he offers something unique to Gareth Southgate that can't really be ignored, because in the last 15, 20 minutes of games, when you need a goal, you will get free kicks on the edge of the box, and there's no one better in the world, really, I don't think, than James Ward-Prowse.
And I think you could probably also argue there's, over the last 2 major tournaments, there's been no better team or no better country at maximising attacking set pieces than England. That might be used by Southgate as an argument that he doesn't need Ward-Prowse and that it's been working pretty well anyway. But we relied on Kieran Trippier for those deliveries before, and he might well not start. So, yeah, I'm not quite as fierce in my opinion on it as Adrian, but he's certainly a good kind of 23rd member of a squad.
All right. Well, there'll be loads of opportunity to discuss Gareth Southgate's plans for England. But that's where we wrap up today's Totally Football Show, European show out midnight Monday. Thursday, we're back with our reaction to the Champions League games. Ooh, and the third fourth playoff in the Intertotally, which will feature Duncan Alexander against Julian Laurens. It's going to be a bitter, bitter battle, that one. The following week, Daniel, it's you against Charlie in the final. How are you feeling?
Yeah, I've always said all along he's the favourite, and I stick by it. Because that self-deprecation is the fuel on which football journalism is based. So.
Right.
It really isn't.
No, it really isn't.
Brilliant stuff. Well, many, many thanks. Look forward to that final and to seeing you all again soon. Thank you so much for being with us today. You as well, listener, and you, producer, Charlie. Do catch up with us at your earliest convenience throughout the week. And for now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.